Friends, good morning. It is Advent season once again, the start of the church calendar year. And the season of Advent, of course, is the period of four Sundays leading up to Christmas. And of course, in Latin, the word Advent means coming. And so these weeks are meant to be a time of anticipation for the thing that is coming. Of course, we prepare our hearts, we prepare ourselves, you could say, for the coming of the birth of Jesus through Mary, right? And the idea is you're supposed to feel the weight of this, the anticipated arrival of something, so that when it actually comes, you'll feel more satisfied and more full of joy at the arrival time. I mean, that's the theory, at least, anyway. That's the hope, I suppose. But it's sort of like, I suppose you could say, booking a holiday out 40 days, and you know, you live in that 40 days sort of with this period of anticipation, or the child, right? When you put the gift under the tree and they've got to wait a whole month before they can open it. That's the sort of idea going on with Advent. But this morning, what I want to do is I want to speak of something that I do not know personally. It's something that I can only know through observation and stories and research. It's, of course, something that is a great mystery to me, but I realized lately that it's far more mysterious than even I imagined. But I want to get into that in a second. But Advent begins with the Annunciation, you could say, this great news brought to Mary. And this is what happens in Luke chapter 1. In the sixth month, Gabriel the angel was sent from God to a town in Galilee called Nazareth to a virgin engaged to a man called Joseph from the family of David. The virgin was called Mary. "Greetings, favored one," said the angel when he arrived. "May the Lord be with you." She was disturbed at this and wondered what such a greeting might mean. "Don't be afraid, Mary," said the angel to her. "You're in favor with God. Listen, you will conceive in your womb and you will have a son and you shall call his name Jesus. He will be a great man and he'll be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of David, his father, and he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever. His kingdom will never come to an end." "How will this happen?" said Mary to the angel. "I'm still a virgin." "The Holy Spirit will come upon you," replied the angel, "and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. For that reason, the Holy One who is born from you will be called God's Son." And let me tell you this too. Your cousin Elizabeth, in her old age, has also conceived a son. This is the sixth month for her, a woman who people used to say was barren. With God, you see, nothing is impossible. "Here I am," said Mary. "I'm the Lord's servant girl. Let it happen to me as you have said." And then the angel left her. You know, the reality of pregnancy and birth has been largely sanitized from our cultural celebrations of Christmas. And for understandable reasons, I suppose, I mean, both are messy affairs and the realities don't fit, you know, perfectly well on Hallmark cards or on Christmas mantles. But it goes to something deeper. It's like female biology has been stigmatized by both mainstream culture and religion. And it gets uncomfortable, right, when we start talking about periods and blood and the lining of the uterus. And yet right here in the story of incarnation is a celebration of a woman's biology. How God chooses to enter the world is no accident. And yet there's a great mystery to me here about this. You see, it's something that I can't quite get my head around. But if God decided that incarnation via pregnancy and birth was worth celebrating, then there must be something about the process itself that lends itself to reflection. And that's what I want to do this morning. And you know, last week we talked about moments of divine encounter. And for Mary, this divine encounter, it comes via the revelation, via the angel. And I want to get more to that next week. But her divine encounter comes by carrying the divine within her for 40 weeks, which I love that pregnancy is about 40 weeks, because in scripture, 40 weeks is always how long, or 40 days is always how long it takes for something to come to fruition. And so Mary's journey is carrying the divine within her for 40 weeks. But what does that look like internally? What was happening to Mary during this time? What happens to any woman who carries a pregnancy? And might reflecting on that yield some insight for us? Well, what is happening during pregnancy, in short, It's a war. And with that this morning, what I want to give to you is the story of pregnancy. And I realize some of what I'm talking about this morning might be like very old news to some of you. But what I've been learning recently is that there's so much more about pregnancy that I had no idea about, even though I've gone through three of them with my wife, Kristen. But the story of pregnancy is actually very complicated. And yet it seems that it's a process so sacred that God chooses incarnation through the sacred process of pregnancy and birth. And so I want to tell you a little bit about the war of pregnancy. Because here's the thing, when a woman is pregnant, she doesn't just create a baby. She grows an entirely new organ, which is wild to me, right? I mean, we men, we don't have a uterus, so this is an experience we will never have. But I mean, consider that. All through life, you've got, right, your heart, you've got your lungs, your bone, your skin, your eyes. But all of a sudden, during pregnancy, a new organ is growing and developing, and it is called the placenta, of course, right? Now, technically, the placenta belongs to the embryo, the fetus, the baby. So it's actually grown by the fetus, which means that every single one of us have had a placenta. Now, Harvey Kleiman, he's a physician scientist at Yale University. He studies the placenta. In fact, he holds one of the world's largest collections of placentas, and his studies around them have been absolutely remarkable to me. You see, when a woman's egg is fertilized, this cluster of cells, it sort of forms in two layers, you could say. There's a little cluster of cells on the inside, right? And that will become the embryo, the fetus, but the cells on the outside become the placenta. And it's like wrapped around the embryo like a little tiny blanket, you could say. And as Harvey explains, and I think as many mothers may know, right, pregnancy is anything but a peaceful affair. In fact, Harvey describes it as this little war happening within a woman's body. It's like this violent cage match of fisticuffs between these two sides, right? Like fighting out of the red corner, you have the pregnant person, but in the blue corner is the fetus and, of course, the placenta wrapped around it like a blanket. And you might say, well, you know, why is this considered a battle, Brad? Well, as Harvey explains, right, this little embryo with placenta cells wrapped around it, it's like a blanket, but it's not welcome in the mother's body. You see, from the mother's point of view, this is immunologically foreign, you could say. It's like having a needle with a vaccine in it stuck in your arm. Her body's going to fight it because the pregnancy is a little bit genetically the mom, but it's also a little bit genetically the dad. And that means that for the mother's body, this isn't normal. This is like not the mother, not the self of the mother. This is like a foreign invasion. This thing is like a virus, a bacteria. So the mother's body is going to fight it. Now, Melissa Wilson, a geneticist at Arizona State University, says that, you know, if the embryo just sort of waltzed, you know, kind of just waltzed into the uterus one day without a little placenta blanket wrapped around it, the mother's body, what it would do is it would gather up this big squad of white blood cells, right? It would send them out to find it and shred it to pieces. Of course, that's a big problem for the little fetus. So what the placenta forms is like this, again, this first little miracle that happens here is that the placenta as a blanket, it hides the embryo. It's kind of like Harry Potter's invisibility cloak, you could say. So the placenta for the first little while, it just makes the embryo completely hidden from the mother's body. She doesn't even know the pregnancy is there. And so for the first week or so of the pregnancy, the placenta is just kind of hiding the embryo, just trying to keep it from being detected. But of course, right, it can't stay hidden forever. The fetus is going to need nutrition. And as the embryo gets hungry, right, the placenta's like, geez, I gotta feed this thing. And this is when the battle lines really start to get drawn, right? Because essentially, this war between the placenta and the pregnant person is really just a war about food and nutrition. And so the placenta, Harvey says, it really has one one mission, just one simple mission, to make this baby as big as possible. It wants to suck as many nutrients out of the mother as possible in order to grow this thing. And the pregnant person has a mission as well. That mission is simple too. It's not to die. And so the placenta is in the uterus scrounging around for food, and it does this one thing. It's something kind of tricky. It produces this hormone that's called HCG. Now, this also happens to be the hormone that activates pregnancy tests. So you pee on the little stick, right? This is the hormone that will let you know you're pregnant or not. But one of its other jobs, this hormone, is to cause the lining of the uterus to secrete a protein that's a little bit like milk. Get some milk going, that way there's at least a little bit of food to start growing this fetus, this baby. But this first little trick, I mean, it's just like the placenta is just biding time here. It's basically just a little snack for the embryo, just enough to keep it going, keep it moving. But the placenta's next move, about 2 weeks into the pregnancy, is to go really on the offensive here. And by now, right, it's latched onto the side of the uterus, right? And at this point, the placenta forms tendrils. Not kidding, it forms tendrils, almost like these long, skinny claws that try to invade the mother's body by breaking through the walls of the uterus. Like the placenta is attacking the mother's uterus walls because it wants to open it up, because if it can open it up and get into a mother's blood vessels, well, if you can do that, then you can suck out all the nutrients that it wants from the mother's body. But the mother's defense against this little thing is incredibly formidable. Basically, it puts up a brick wall. It's very dense tissue that block these claw-like little tendrils from getting in. And so now the battle is really on, right? But the placenta, of course, is resilient. It's not going to give up easily. And so it keeps digging and digging at the walls of the uterus, but the uterus keeps blocking it. And so at this point, it's like a full-on knuckle match, right? The placenta attacking, the mother blocking all of it. It's like each side is exchanging blows and defending, and the placenta keeps digging and digging and digging, aggressively attacking the uterus walls, and the uterus keeps blocking, putting up a brick wall, blocking it. And so now we're about 4 weeks into pregnancy, right? And with the placenta repeatedly attacking and trying to suck out the blood of the mother while the mother is putting up this defensive showcase, it's boxing it out. But the fight is just getting started, because by week 7, the embryo, it's growing eyes, it's growing ears, it has heart, kidneys, liver. Meanwhile, the placenta is just digging, trying to get blood out of the mother to get this thing more nutrients. But the placenta, it can't break through. It can't do it. And so it's screaming. You could say, come on, I have to grow this thing. I need more nutrients for my little buddy, the fetus here. But the uterus, right, is like, hell no, get out of here. You're trying to kill me. But the placenta, you could say, has studied Muay Thai. It has more tricks up its sleeve. And it's going to pull a real fast one here. Specifically, the placenta has one tricky sort of submission move, you could say, and it's called PP13. Now, it's a protein that Harvey says that essentially creates a diversion. I'll let Harvey explain how this works. I like his analogy. Here's an analogy. If we wanted to rob a bank, I don't want the police to be near there. So what I'm going to do is blow up a grocery store, wait for all the police to sort of go around the grocery store, and while they're busy doing that, I'm going to sneak into the bank. So in the world of Harvey's analogy here, PP13, right, is kind of like blowing up the grocery store. The placenta produces it, and what it does is it goes off to some other place in the uterus that the placenta isn't trying to break into. And there, the mother suddenly thinks, oh my goodness, the attack location has changed. And so the PP13 attracts all the mother's, you know, defense force. Like the police are out there, the SWAT team, everybody is on call, sirens wailing, heading to this other location, right? And all of this is happening. And while the police force is over there dealing with PP13, the placenta's claws keep digging until they finally bust through. And then blood fountains into the placenta. And of course, this blood is bathed in all these nutrients. And so it's like buffet time for the fetus. It's like it's at the Mandarin, just chowing down, gobbling up everything around it. And with that, it starts growing and growing and growing. It's by the size of a grapefruit at week 15, a pineapple by week 24, a watermelon by week 36. And the baby is demanding more and more horsepower, more and more nutrients to keep growing, to actually grow. And so it's sucking more and more and more from the mother. And the placenta keeps going because it starts releasing more and more of this hormone called human placental lactogen, which sort of what it does is it hijacks the mother's digestive system. It's like a mother is eating, but none of it's really actually for her. She won't be able to store any of it because the nutrients remain in her blood, so the fetus can suck those nutrients up, right? And all the while, the placenta is gobbling up more and more of the mother's blood. In fact, Harvey says by the third trimester, between 20 and 25% of all blood flow in a mother is going to the placenta. And this is where things can get really, really dangerous for the mother. You see, if the placenta and the fetus don't feel like they're getting enough blood, they can force the mother's body to start pumping more blood into this fountaining system with a condition. It's called preeclampsia, something like that. I think it's pronounced like that. And this is a very scary and serious condition because what it does is it essentially spikes a mother's blood pressure so high that she can actually die from it. And you know, of course, blood pressure might not sound that serious to us, but essentially what you have is this placenta that's sucking so much blood out of the mother's body that it can make it hard for her to survive. And this is the messy, scary phenomenon we call pregnancy. The dance between mother and fetus placenta. And because the thing is this, right, it can work the other way as well, because the mother's body, it doesn't want the fetus to take all of her nutrients. But if she is successful, if the mother's successful and wins that battle, then the fetus will be too small and the pregnancy may not survive. But if this sort of cage match, this internal cage match, if it essentially ends in a draw, a stalemate, well, then after 40 weeks, give or take a few, poof, voila, you have a baby. But of course, even after baby's born, you have the placenta still in the mother's body, right? And so the placenta actually has to kind of be born itself, you could say. And it's interesting because Harvey believes this process is another little miracle. You see, the uterus is like elastic muscle. And so after the baby is born, it contracts down. And in doing so, it shears the placenta off the lining of the uterus. And the placenta gets delivered. And then all those blood vessels that have been supplying blood to the placenta for all those weeks and all those months, they close down almost immediately. And so there's this river of blood, right, that's fountaining into the placenta and it just gets shut off. And what's kind of cool is that Harvey and others think that it might be one of the only things in the body like this, maybe the only thing where something sort of gets sheared off in the body and it leaves no scar. I find that fascinating. The whole process ends, placenta sheared off, no mark remains. And so in the end, you could say there's this sort of peace that is found between placenta in the mother's body. There's this wrestling match for 40 weeks, this push and this pull, this fight and this competition between mother and placenta. But in the end, there's almost like this camaraderie, a peace of sorts, because together, wrestling with each other, they've birthed a new life into the world. The story of Jesus' incarnation is to start a celebration of a woman's biology and a portrait of the spiritual life. You know, how God chooses to enter the world is, of course, no accident. It's a celebration, you could say, of divine participation through the body of a woman. But what that looks like and what that feels like is no accidents. It's a push and pull wrestling match. And as Mary carried the divine within her on her way to birthing new life, inside of her was this full-on war, this battle. Of course, we know that in Genesis, we're given one of my favorite stories, the story of Jacob, who late one night finds himself wrestling with God. And Jacob would go on to be named Israel, which means the one who wrestles with God, right? And so to me, this is interesting because the story of faith has always been one of wrestling with God, except now in Mary, we see that the wrestling match has gone internal. It's a war that's waged inside of us. And so I can only imagine, right, like Mary's excitement, her fear, her puzzlement as this angel announces she's going to carry this Jesus child into the world. God incarnate will have a mother. God incarnate in Jesus still has a mother. But I can imagine, of course, that as the angel left, right, and the reality of the announcement sets in, like, what's Mary thinking? She must have been fixed with just so many mixed emotions, right? It's like, could this really be true? Would she really be the one who would birth God into the world? Would she be the one to birth life and hope into the world? And I can imagine her standing there, her astonishment, right, her excitement. And all the while, this little blanket-wrapped embryo is hiding within her, waiting for the moment to make its presence known, waiting for the wrestling match to begin. And then for Mary, I can imagine the excitement of this announcement, the excitement of this news gives way to reality with her first bout of morning sickness. The reality of the war waging inside of her begins. I, of course, don't know this firsthand, but I can only imagine that nothing can ruin the euphoria of discovering you're pregnant faster than feeling the need to vomit. And although it's not confined to just the beginning of the day, right? Morning sickness is the term we use to describe the nausea, the vomiting that affects 4 out of 5 mothers in the first trimester of pregnancy. And I've heard it described, I love this, I've heard morning sickness described as like having a hangover without getting to experience the party the night before. I love that. I think that's hilarious. Yeah, I'm hungover, but I didn't have a whole lot of fun last night either. It's a discomfort, right, that only women will know. But what they also know is that this feeling of sickness, this nausea, is producing within them a new life. And I can imagine that it's bearable, just barely at times, because of the deep hope and joy of knowing you're birthing something new. You know, I remember when Kristen was pregnant, I mean, just watching her go through morning sickness, I remember for at least 2 of her pregnancies, right? While she was teaching at school, she had a garbage bin beside her because there are moments where in the middle of teaching, she was just sick. And I mean, imagine that, right? Like this feeling of sickness that many women experience when they're pregnant. I mean, oh, there's a battle waging inside of them and it has consequences. And I mean, think of that for Mary. I mean, just think about what this might mean for her. For Mary, the presence of God in her life felt like morning sickness. I find that idea wild. And I suppose what it means is this, is don't be surprised if nausea and unease are part of our experience with the presence of God. The presence of God in our lives with us. Incarnation is not the stuff of nostalgic postcards, but the gritty reality of pregnancy and birth. And of course, we know the presence of God met Jacob in the form of a wrestling match, and it left him with a limp. And for Mary, the presence of God within her was also a wrestling match, an internal one that at times left her feeling nauseous. The presence of God to Mary meant sleepless nights and then waking up to queasy mornings. And I'm inclined to think there's something there for us to learn as well. We should expect nothing less. This is just part of the deal when it comes for waiting for hope and new life in our own lives. This is the process of how God and love and hope and salvation are birthed into our world. And what I so love about the story of the Annunciation is after this overwhelming message, this incredible announcement to Mary of what will happen to her if she is willing, she of course says what? "Here I am," said Mary. "I'm the Lord's servant girl. Let it happen to me as you've said." You know, I don't doubt that Mary perhaps did not know the ins and outs about pregnancy and what it would feel like, but I love this moment because it's a moment of surrender. It's a surrendering on Mary's part. Yes, I will participate. I will participate in what God is up to. I'll participate in that with my body. And so she surrenders to the push and pull. She surrenders to a wrestling match inside of her. And the process is always uneasy because growth never comes with ease. It comes through the stretching and expanding of ourselves. And at times, like Jacob, it leaves us with a limp. And at times, it leaves us dry heaving on the sidelines like Mary. But this is how God comes at that first Christmas. And I'm inclined to think that this is how God still comes into our world, how hope still arrives in our world. And so like Mary, may we be willing to say, "Let it happen to me as you have said."